We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today's episode is a conversation I had over Zoom with Megan Basham of The Daily Wire. She's one of the few people in conservative media who has a job title similar to mine. She's the culture reporter over at The Daily Wire, and she's recently penned a very important investigation. It's an investigation into an investigation, and that would be the Southern Baptist Convention's recent probing of the way the church has handled sexual assault claims. And my conversation with Megan, it actually covered more ground than that, but her article itself is well worth considering. The mainstream media both doesn't cover these things enough, and when it does, gets them completely and totally and wildly wrong. So it's a broad-ranging conversation about really the SBC, which is one of the biggest religious organizations in the country, and it's a very powerful one. So Megan's insight is extremely useful. It's a fascinating conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. Megan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Emily. I'm glad to finally get together with you because we have such similar jobs.
Yes, absolutely. We had a fun time recording some video reviews of Shut In, the Daily Wire Entertainment production, which I thought was really fantastic a couple of months ago. And it's been lovely to get to know you, Megan. You're a fantastic reporter and writer.
Well, thank you. Same to you. And we missed you at the Terror on the Prairie. I was like, where is Emily?
Looks like you guys had a lot of fun.
It was, but it was really, really hot. So you missed out on some good sweating there.
Yeah, I try not to go to the South in the summer.
Yeah, that was a wise decision.
Wisconsin people, it's not where we belong. So Megan, actually, on a more serious note, has written, I think, a really smart and helpful and fairly brave piece of reporting on something that has basically roiled this gigantic world that nobody in really the legacy media has their finger on the pulse of at all. They basically are completely blind to what's happening in the biggest Protestant denomination in the country, the second biggest Christian denomination in the entire country, and that would be the SBC. Megan, did this recent wave, I mean, there's been a lot of controversy over wokeness when it comes to the SBC, and we should say that's the Southern Baptist Convention. There's been this sort of tug of war over wokeness in the SBC in recent years. Some people feel like it's getting a little bit too socially liberal, and some people think it's not socially liberal enough, and that's already been a problem. But now, tell us about the report this time around that has the SBC roiled in controversy. And then we'll get into, I think, the way you handled it in your story. But what started this most recent wave of controversy at the SBC?
Right. Well, it's interesting that you bring up kind of the wokeness angle, because I don't want to draw dividing lines through this report on that basis, except that you did see a lot of people who, some of the pastors who were known for saying things like the Bible whispers about sexual sin, kind of referring to homosexuality. Some of the pastors who have been a little bit more in the forefront of what you might call the racial reconciliation, which kind of morphed into what some would say was a CRT movement and bringing in sort of ethnic partiality is a term you hear. They kind of split along similar lines on this question. So it's really impossible to get away from it when you're talking about it. So what happened was essentially there have been allegations of abuse within the SBC. And I think you can say, like any denomination, there were plenty of true allegations. But the question was the degree to which this was a serious problem within the SBC. So a task force was created. And the way this task force came about, that's why I bring it up. There was a lot of in the background political wrangling, a lot of it seemed like personal divisions going on that kind of led to this. But then this task force was put in place to investigate abuse within the SBC. And what really sparked it on the surface was some reports from the Houston Chronicle that demonstrated, you know, about 400, 500 cases within the SBC where there were allegations. So let's be clear that not all of these cases have been investigated and adjudicated. So at that point, this was a year ago, they put this task force in place, and it had a year to come back and hire an independent investigator. They hired a company called Guidepost, which is a secular independent company, to look into these allegations that the executive committee of the SBC. So the SBC is a very loose organization. You have to get ideas of like Catholic hierarchy out of your head. It is not like that. They don't have someone at the top telling churches, you know, this is the pastor you're going to hire, or we're going to send this guy over here. It doesn't work like that. These are all independent churches that decide to associate based on their similar theological convictions in order to do things like pool money to send missionaries out into the world. So it is a very much, if you want to associate with us, you can. If you don't, that's fine. You know, it's a very low bar of what you have to agree with to be in this Southern Baptist Association. So a year goes by, Guidepost comes back with the results of that investigation. It was about 8 months, I would say, they put into it. And they release their results. You see a flurry of headlines, some by people like David French, saying that this proves that the Southern Baptist Convention does not just have a few bad apples, but it is a diseased orchard. You had someone like a former Southern Baptist Convention leader, Russell Moore, who was the head of their lobbying arm, the ERLC, which is the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, I think it's commission, who said that, you know, this is an apocalypse. You saw headlines in the Washington Post, New York Times. I mean, everyone's been covering it, saying this is a bombshell. It is explosive. Now, two things about that is, one, that the investigation itself was pretty limited in scope. And the second thing about that is what they found, while, you know, there's some certainly some upsetting things in that report, my position was, when you actually looked at the numbers, it was very far from meriting terms like apocalypse or explosive. Largely what they found was that the executive committee of the SBC had a list that included accused abusers. And when they really looked into it, they said, we've got about 409 individuals connected at some point to the SBC over a period of 21 years in 47,000 churches. So that's total, 409 people, 47,000 churches over 21 years. Two were still connected to the SBC. So that's current. So when you break those numbers down, you go, okay, so they had this list. And the other thing to know about the list is that the list was collated from public reports, from arrest records, from newspaper records. A large part of it was simply put together from literally Google alerts. Some members of the executive committee just set a Google alert, and when they would get one, they would add it to this list. So everything on the list was in the public domain. So that, you know, it's kind of a long form explanation of what this report itself was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really helpful because I think it's important then what you did in terms of organizing your report is you took it in what I kind of categorized as two parts. First, what is the actual scale of the offense, and what is the actual scale of this alleged pattern? What does it look like? And the French quote about not a few bad apples, but a diseased orchard, I think is super instructive in terms of representing a media narrative, not just in the Dispatch, right, that I think was parroted, you know, when they see what people like David French, who's a sort of interlocutor between, you know, the secular sort of legacy media world and the evangelical community, that's sort of taken very seriously. It legitimizes the idea that this is explosive, that this is apocalyptic, and that this is all a diseased orchard. So what you did was actually look at the numbers, which I didn't really see anybody else doing. You talked to Lyman Stone. So what is the scope of these allegations when you actually did try to quantify what happened?
Right. So I'll just tell you straight up, I got, you know, a considerable amount of pushback from people saying, well, these are just the numbers we know about. Well, two things I would say to that is, one, The Houston Chronicle also did like an 18-month, I can't remember the exact term, but they did a deep dive investigation over the course of maybe about a year. And their numbers looked very similar. And that was an investigation of the entire SBC, not just what the executive committee, which is, you know, the national leadership, was doing. And they came up with the very similar numbers to what this Guidepost report found, which was, again, 409 individuals. And that includes, you know, staff, workers, and volunteers. So consider about how many volunteers we're talking about in 47,000 churches over the course of 21 years. So that was why I went to talk to Lyman Stone, because I said, look, the reality is every pastor that I spoke to, and I spoke to a lot of pastors, and most of them off the record, because they were sending me all these DMs going, this just does not seem really fair. I'll just say straight up. They said, this does not seem like it's an accurate representation of where the SBC is to say that we're facing an apocalypse or diseased orchard. And so I went to Lyman Stone, who's a demographer at the Institute for Family Studies. And he's one of the few guys going, yeah, I don't see it. I mean, if you want to say there is a problem with how leadership handled some allegations, that's certainly fair game. But in terms of saying that this is a systemic rampant problem within this denomination, these numbers don't show it. And so the critics would say, well, we don't know all the numbers. And I go, well, we can't really deal in hypothetical numbers. We actually need to deal with what we have. And again, the Houston Chronicle's numbers, which were an investigation of the entire SBC, were very similar. So I think you have to say, and we can speculate on the reasons that this was being quite intentionally portrayed as a really deep, widespread problem. And I don't think you can say that the actual statistics support that. And let me just get the boilerplate out of the way, which is, look, any instance of abuse is terrible. We do not want people abused. We don't want people assaulted or harassed, or certainly in the case of minors and children, we don't want molestation happening in churches. So that is terrible. So let's get that out of the way. Nobody is minimizing or excusing that behavior. But at the same time, I hope we can be at least rational enough to go, okay, but do these descriptor terms match what we're actually seeing?
Something we talk about a lot on this podcast is how recent changes to the way humans live their everyday lives have caused all of these other downstream changes that are pretty major and that we don't actually think about that often. For instance, did you know that poor sleep can cause weight gain, mood issues, poor mental health, and lower productivity? Think about this. Sleeping less than 6 to 7 hours per night is actually linked to reduced white blood cell count. And those white blood cells protect our body against illnesses and diseases. They fight viruses, they fight bacteria, and so much more. I am one of those people that absolutely needs critical sleep. I need absolutely more sleep than most people probably do, but it's a huge difference, and we all know that because we all need it. Introducing Beam Dream. Beam is the world's most innovative functional wellness brand with unique products for everything from sleep to recovery. And today, our listeners get a special discount available for Beam's sleep product, Dream Powder, their best-selling healthy hot cocoa. It contains natural, sleep-promoting premium ingredients, triple lab-tested, no THC, and you wake up feeling refreshed, which in my opinion is just about the best feeling in the world. 98% of people surveyed fall asleep faster when taking Beam Dream, and 99% of people experience better sleep quality. You just mix Beam Dream into hot water or milk, you stir it, and you enjoy it before bedtime. Just taking the stuff out of the box, I took a look at it and said, this is awesome. You can find out why Forbes and New York Times are all talking about Beam and why it's trusted by the world's top business professionals and top athletes. Don't love it? You can get your money back guaranteed. For a limited time, get up to 35% off when you go to shopbeam.com/Federalist and use code Federalist at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/Federalist and use code Federalist for up to 35% off.
I'm a good man on the table.
So then the second part of your article gets at that exactly. How, what do we know then about, you know, now that we've established the scale, what do we know about how either poorly or well the SBC handled allegations when they were brought forth?
Well, so some of what I would say is, you know, some legitimate critique of what happened. So again, this guidepost, not a Christian organization, secular organization, did this 8-month-long investigation. And some of the things they found was that on a local level, accusers were bringing allegations to the executive committee. Now, the executive committee's argument is, we were not the right place to bring those. We, because of our Baptist polity, which means we are all just sort of a loose association of churches, we don't have authority over each other, we were not the right place to bring those allegations. And so in a lot of cases, fearing that they were going to open themselves up to lawsuits and other legal ramifications, they did nothing. And they sort of said, take your allegations somewhere else. Or in a couple of, and again, but we are only talking about a handful, maybe like 4 or 5 in the report, where they said they just didn't respond, period. And I think you can say that's not great. When someone brings you an allegation of abuse, you do something with it. So that's just me editorializing, and they may have some pushback on that. But so that's, you know, I think that to me was the most legitimate part of the critique, was when people bring you allegations, you can't just say we can't do anything with this, so let's not answer or let's not respond. So that is kind of the key of where a lot of the critique lies. Internally, not the external media coverage. So the other part of it, though, they hired this firm, Guidepost, and they were performing this investigation and making recommendations in a way that's very similar to what some abuse victims advocates are asking for on the national level as far as recommendations. And so the second part of my report was looking at, okay, well, how did this firm handle some of these allegations themselves? Once you have determined, okay, the executive committee didn't do a great job with this, what would you have wanted them to do then? And so then I looked at the most prominent case in this report, and that's where it got really deep in the weeds. And it's going to sound similar to anybody who has spent a lot of time watching how campuses have handled rape and harassment and assault allegations. So essentially, there was the key case. It's a woman named Jennifer Lyle and a professor named David Sills. So if you'll bear with me for a second, Emily, we're going to go deep in the weeds of this this most prominent case of the Guidepost report. So this was the one where they really showed this is how they egregiously handled the executive committee and allegation. So Jennifer Lyle was 26 years old on the campus of Southern Seminary. She was a Master of Divinity student. And it is actually not clear if she had a class with this professor. They worked in a department. She was working in a department where he was working and had volunteers and students working. So at 26, they meet. He said, you know, she may have been in one of my classes. I don't know. I had a really large seminar class and I haven't been able to determine that. So for 2 years, she's on that campus. She meets him. They begin some sort of relationship. And, you know, there are two different versions of what this relationship was. She becomes very close to the family, to his wife, to his high school age daughter, to his college age son. So very close to them. And for 2 years, she's there in Kentucky. This relationship, interaction, whatever you want to call it, begins. It continues until she's 38 for another 10 years. In that time, she moves to Chicago to work for Moody Publishers. And she contracts with him for books. And at that point, I might say she had more authority over him than he did over her as an editor and publishing executive who's soliciting books from him and editing his work. She also moves on to Nashville to work at Lifeway. Same deal. She's publishing books with him. She's working with him professionally. She does not live in the same state as this family. And she says that over the course of all that time, he was a violent sexual abuser of her from 26 to 38. And so already you go, okay, you know, questions arise, certainly, about what this relationship was. And Jennifer Lyle did not detail specifically what she meant by violent abuse. That's nowhere in the public record. So in 2018, at the height of the Me Too movement, she's working at Lifeway and some story comes up about abuse and she tells her boss, I was sexually abused. So the relationship ended, by the way, in 2016. So 2 years later, she tells her boss at Lifeway, at this point, she's about 40, I was sexually abused by this professor. They take those allegations to Southern Seminary and to Southern Seminary's president, Dr. Albert Moeller. He has a private in-depth conversation with Jennifer Lyle, believes her. And when David Sills, this professor, comes back from overseas a couple of days later, he is fired. So about a year after that, the Baptist Press, and this is the communications arm, the news arm of the Southern Baptist Convention, but it falls under the authority of that executive committee. So she says, I would like to write, her boss encouraged her, by the way, let's make that clear. So you should write a first person story. This is, you know, a really important topic. Everyone's talking about it. Why don't you write a first person story about what happened to you? Baptist Press decides, let's just do an article. And in this article, she terms it abuse, sexual abuse. In the course of, you know, submitting it to the executive committee, I don't know what their process is for approving, but somehow the executive committee members, which has several lawyers on it, get a look at this article and say, looking at the facts of this case and the broad outlines of it, I don't know that we're comfortable saying that this was sexual abuse. Largely because I think they thought he could sue us if he has not confessed and no charges have been filed. And you know, we don't really have any grounds to say this was sexual abuse. So right before they go to press, they inform Jennifer Lyle, we're not going to call this sexual abuse. We have other quotes from you that indicate what you felt like it was. She said she was groomed and taken advantage of. That was still in the article. But they changed sexual abuse to an immoral relationship. And then it goes to press. Well, at that point, people on Facebook, on the Baptist Press account page start saying, well, now, wait a minute, this professor lost his job and this woman's still employed. And you're saying it's abuse, not an immoral relationship. Why does she have her job and he doesn't? And a lot of questions. And at that point, Jennifer Lyle tells her story to a very well-known attorney and victim herself, Rachel Den Hollander. If you're not familiar with Rachel Den Hollander, she was one of the first Larry Nassar accusers in the gymnast scandal. And Larry Nassar is obviously now in prison, and she did heroic work, I will say, with that. So Rachel Den Hollander mentions this from the stage at an SBC conference with Russell Moore. She calls him a rapist, I believe. She says he's violent. She talks about how the executive committee mistreated Jennifer Lyle by doing this. And about right after that, she represents Jennifer Lyle in an action against the executive committee. They didn't sue, but they threatened to sue, and that was mediated. So sources tell me that the insurance company for the executive committee did not want to settle because they felt like it wasn't a great case, but they were having terrible negative press from that conference. So they said, just settle with her for, I'm hearing reportedly about $1 million. And that is the story. And that, from the basis of that, Guidepost went ahead and said, this man was a sexual abuser. And from there, this was part of what made up the recommendation saying we need a public ministry list of men like this who would go on this public list of men who are abusers, not alleged. And if you read the report, they don't say alleged. They say he's an abuser. We never saw any other evidence that said he wasn't an abuser. And so this is why we need a list like this. Mm. So at that point, I go, this story is a little confusing. And I said, well, let's look a little deeper into this story, because I mean, I think you can look at it and go, I don't know what happened here, but I think it's reasonable to have questions. And to me, it was reasonable for the executive committee to go, I don't know that we want to say this is definitely abuse.
And part of what the problem with the guidepost report is the recommendations going forward. So can you tell us, I mean, obviously the list is deeply problematic, both in theory and in practice. But what can you tell us about how guidepost recommended the SBC go forward to prevent, you know, arguably from their perspective, to prevent similar issues in the future?
Well, I think a lot of these things were really reasonable. You know, I mean, there were certainly things on it that you would go, I don't think most people would have any argument with that. And they were things like, let's have more training. Let's have more guardrails put in place for when we're bringing on workers, do background checks, do things like make sure they've been through training processes to understand, to see red flags, to recognize trauma, things like that. That's all fair. As far as this list goes, they also had things like, if you've had a criminal charge against you, you should be on that list. If you have confessed, you should be on that list. So I think those are things that, you know, most people would say are reasonable. But it was the, if you have been credibly accused by a third party investigator, you should go on that list. And that was where the issue came in. So if I can go back to my own reporting now a little bit and talk about why that was problematic. If you look at this Lyle Sills case, I kind of wrote in the article that if they did not see any evidence that he was anything other than a violent sexual abuser, it may have been because they were not looking for any evidence like that. So when I started looking into the case, I went, what they list as corroboration in that report is simply the people who believed Lyle when she told them. So they mentioned Dr. Mueller. They mentioned his former pastor, who, by the way, was also on the faculty and basically working for Mueller at Southern Seminary. And they said, well, his former pastor believed it. Her boss believed it. So what they had as corroboration were people who believed her. That's not really corroboration. That's just saying, here's some prominent people, incredible people who believed her story, but they did not have any evidence of their own to offer. And I think that's key to point out, because when I started talking to some people who worked at Southern Seminary at the time, they saw things a little differently. Like, I talked to one professor, a man named Russell Fuller, who was there at the time, and said, I saw them together. I did think that they probably had an inappropriate relationship based on how they were behaving. When I saw them eating lunch together, he just went, ooh, that doesn't look right. They were laughing. They were sitting very close together. And he said to me, what I thought was, well, they must not be guilty, because nobody who's, you know, guilty would be that obvious. They would be more careful to hide it. So that was one. So you had an eyewitness who said it looked consensual to me, their relationship. Then in a report, in that Baptist Press story, Jennifer Lyle said, I reported him to the Louisville PD. And then in a later interview, a videotaped interview she did with some kind of theology bloggers, I heard she said again that she called the Louisville PD, and also that Dr. Mueller reported Sills to the Louisville PD. Well, I called Louisville PD. They had no record of Sills, Lyle, or Mueller. So already you go, okay, well, that's a hard public record. So we know that she either is very mistaken or she was not telling the truth about that. And then I spoke to Lyle and she told me, oh, I made a mistake. It was the Jeffersontown PD, which is, you know, another precinct that's close by, and said it was actually the Jeffersontown PD. I called them as well. They also do not have any records of any of them, and nothing matching the description of this case.
Did any of the journalists do that?
No. And in fact, what I can tell you is the Religion News Service reporter, Bob Smiatana, reported that Sills admitted to abuse, which was not the case. I communicated through an intermediary with the Sills family. They don't want to talk to the media. In some sense, that's somewhat understandable. But basically, through this friend, he directly said to me, I have never confessed or admitted to abuse. I admit to a sinful relationship. That's what I admit to. So you go, wow, so that's really bad. And so Guidepost didn't try to talk to David Sills, as far as he knows, he says. And they didn't try to talk to the first person Lyle told, which was her boss, Eric Geiger, at Lifeway. So you go, they did not try to talk to some pretty key people in this story before they said, this man's a sexual abuser, and this is an example of why you need a list.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows, you can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/Federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794 8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist.
I mean, that's the... And that's basically what I was getting at. You know, when you look at how this story in and of itself played out, it's great reason to be suspicious or skeptical of how they want to handle things going forward. But it's also a perfect representation of that, because they're saying it's an example of why they need to do what they think they need to do going forward, which is strange, because if anything, it seems to present the opposite.
Right. I mean, and maybe if you didn't look any deeper into the story, you would go, yeah, you know, they probably, if it were me, I wouldn't have published that story. I think you could argue that the Baptist press and the executive committee should have just spiked the story and said, look, this is very messy. Mm-hmm. It's very unclear what happened here. So let's just not run this story. Now, I think that's a fair argument. But the people who are saying, how dare they not unquestioningly support her allegation of abuse, that to me was a reasonable question to have.
Now, you explicitly invoked the problems that the Time's Up organization had in your article with the Daily Wire, which I think was smart. If folks don't remember, Time's Up was this group that was basically created as a legal defense fund in the midst of the Me Too movement, so that Hollywood could say they were taking steps to clean up the industry and clean up sexual abuses in the industry. It turned out to be something of a grift and a racket that has basically already dissolved. Megan, what do you think the relevance of the Time's Up story is in this case?
Well, so, you know, one of the things that we obviously saw with that Time's Up story was that there were conflicts of interest. You had attorneys who had worked in the Obama administration who were, you know, left-wing activists. They had argued before the Supreme Court as liberal lawyers. And in that case, when they received an allegation, or when there was relevant information to someone on the left, in this case, Andrew Cuomo, they buried it. And in fact, they helped torpedo the reputation of his accuser. They helped, and it's been a while since I reported on this, but if I remember right, they advised on an op-ed that he ran. I don't remember which newspaper it was. Was it the New York Times? It might have been the New York Times, but
yeah don't quote me on that.
But it was one of the big, you know, papers. Andrew Cuomo wrote a piece sort of lampooning the reputation of his accuser. And they advised on that piece on Cuomo's behalf, not the accuser. So that would certainly seem to fly in the face of what Time's Up said its mission was. Well, we didn't see something quite to that level with this Guidepost report, but here's what we did see. So that attorney, Rachel Den Hollander, again, she represented Lyle in a case, in a suit that did not, you know, that didn't end up being a lawsuit, but just a threat of a lawsuit against the executive committee. They received $1 million settlement. Well, when this task force was put in place, they wanted advisors, and they appointed Rachel Den Hollander to be one of their chief advisors, and she recommended hire Guidepost.
Mm.
So you go, you know, and I talked to several legal experts, and some told me it's a gray area. It depends on what kind of disclaimers you got. Others told me I just see a conflict of interest here. Now, they're saying in a general sense, I won't say, you know, I would say it raises ethical questions. They said, I don't know if she's in violation of anything. I wouldn't do it. So it was more like that. People just went, it's definitely questionable. And she was reportedly in communication with the CEO of Guidepost, a woman named Julie Wood, as this investigation was ongoing. And so one of the things you look at when you see this is, one, why would you have an attorney who represented a client in action against the executive committee take part in investigations into the executive committee? At that point, you have to question, how fair is this?
Mm-hmm.
So along with that, Rachel Den Hollander has been pretty outspoken on her friend J.D. Greer, who's a megachurch pastor. He was a former SBC president just recently, and he's been very outspoken on the subject of abuse. And she has said had nothing really but praise for him publicly, and his backing of the recommendations and his backing of policies that she prefers. Well, J.D. Greer did not appear in any negative way in this report, despite the fact that he himself, a couple of years ago, hired a pastor who has been accused of covering up sex crimes at a previous church. And that is certainly the kind of thing that the Guidepost report was looking into and documenting. So you wondered, why was this particular pastor not included in this report, when certainly he should have been by their own structure of what they said they were looking for?
So, I mean, back to the bigger picture, it does sound like some good will come out of this in terms of, as you mentioned, Megan, training and steps that are being implemented to just create a basic sort of system of defense, more formalized system of defense or prevention, or even just monitoring so people know when something seems off or, you know, anything like that. But it's also interesting because it reminds me of a story that my co-host over at The Hill, Ryan Grimm, wrote in The Intercept last week, which was about how wokeness is kind of crippling the basic functionality of a lot of organizations on the left. And for me, Ryan asked me on last week's show, is this happening on the right at all? And I said, no. I mean, I could think of like some, you know, complaining that happens from younger folks that, you know, it's more like psychological, that kind of, you know, I'm having a bad day, I need time off, that kind of thing. But it does seem like maybe the SBC is a good example of an institution. I mean, if the last 5 years have proven anything, it's that some of this radical leftism has crept into every corner of the United States. Like, it doesn't matter whether you're in Kansas or Manhattan, there's going to be some crazy books in your kid's library, most likely. And I wonder, I don't want to minimize this as wokeness, but I think there's sort of a broader conversation about the SBC that, like, a lot of this does seem to stem from the political infighting that's happened in the SBC over the last couple of years. And I guess I'm curious for your take on, you know, is there something that's really hampering questioning the SBC as an institution on its ability to serve its flock by some of this internecine conflict over ideology that's getting what seems to be like a little bit out of control.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good question. It's funny because I go, I don't know how much of it is wokeness within the SBC as it is maybe a targeting from a woke media on the outside, and they've gone into a crouching position is kind of what I see. I feel like I said, that they are so afraid of being seen in any way to be minimizing or dismissing abuse, that this has been a way to really punch hard at them. And, you know, they would say that if you're not familiar with SBC's theology, one of the key tenets of it is a thing called complementarianism, which believes that men and women have separate roles in the home, in the world, and that the pastorate is reserved for men. There's been a lot of criticism on that. Now, here is the thing. People get very angry when you suggest maybe something in this is connected to that criticism of that ideology, except when you look at it in the media, there was a Vox story immediately after this abuse that directly tied it to complementarianism and said, gosh, it feels like this is a patriarchal problem because women's voices aren't being heard in leadership. And maybe you wouldn't have had this problem if you had more women in leadership. Now, to go link to that, another report that Guidepost did in this sort of evangelical world was on Christianity Today last year. Mm-hmm. And in that report, Guidepost very specifically said, we don't find a lot of sexual harassment in Christianity Today, which, if you're not familiar, sort of the flagship magazine of evangelicalism established by Billy Graham. And it has unquestionably drifted left, I think you have to say, on a lot of its ideology in recent years. And so one of the things that Guidepost said was, they don't have a lot of harassment, but what they do have is this sort of, I don't know if they use the word patriarchal, but they said it has this sort of chauvinistic culture in which women are talked over and they feel like they're micromanaged. And that could be contributing to the problem of sexual harassment that isn't that bad, which didn't really make a lot of sense to me. But you go, okay, so people get kind of mad when you draw that line, except for you go, this secular institution that you have invited in now to judge your denomination is drawing those lines, that there is a connection between, yes, this sort of masculine patriarchal environment. And it very specifically said women not being in leadership may have contributed to this problem. And for me, I kind of went, okay, look, that's kind of the microaggression thing, right? Well, men talk over you and you feel micromanaged. I'm like, well, how do you know they're not talking over men? How do you know they're not micromanaging the men? You know what I mean? It's just, it's very, you know, eye of the beholder kind of stuff. Sorry, that was a long-winded answer, but to get back to the SBC, it does very much feel like, in a large part, I feel like they're responding to negative media portrayals. They don't want to be seen fighting back and being defensive about the subject of abuse for obvious reasons. And then I do think you have people inside the denomination who do believe that this is a patriarchal, damaging to women environment, and we would like to see a change to have women have more powerful voices. And that is what you're seeing in the mainstream media. That's the connections that they're making. One of the things that kind of definitely set off alarm bells is that right after this report came out, Rachel Denhollander gave an interview to Russell Moore. And in that interview, one of the things she said was that if you're asking victims for a high level of specific detail, that's kind of a voyeuristic approach to abuse. And you might yourself, that might signal that you yourself are an abuser. That was so similar to me to these discussions about race, right? Mm-hmm. That if you question it, if you're looking for, okay, I need to see evidence, you yourself are, you're dismissing racism, and that might show some innate sort of form of racism in you. And it just sounded so familiar to me.
It's also very derivative of and sort of subtly rhyming with what a lot of radical feminist theory says about questioning. So, and this is to your point about how it's reminiscent of what happened on college campuses. It's actually why a lot of college campuses didn't have cross-examination processes in this these adjudicating campus sexual assault allegations, because it was considered voyeuristic or unfair to question accusers.
Or traumatizing, re-traumatizing. You
exactly.
Hear
that. Yeah, so it does sound like she's pulling completely from that well. And Megan, I'm so curious. You follow this really closely, and it's just really excellent reporting. What can you tell us about the media's relationship with the SBC? It does seem as though they use the SBC as kind of a wedge between like secular society and Christians and people of faith to say, like, look at how this institution is struggling or resisting modernization efforts or struggling with its own problems, that it's kind of used or held up by the legacy media as a representation of Christianity anytime there's a struggle, anytime there's something that can be pointed to almost undermine the credibility of the faith. It feels like that's when you see the media turning to cover the SBC. But just as somebody who follows this with a more nuanced perspective, what do you see in terms of the media's relationship with the SBC as it covers it? What are they getting wrong? Are they getting anything right? And then where do the, this is really teeing you up, I know, but where do the David Frenches of the world factor into that equation?
Well, I mean, one of the things you have to say is, and it's not Christianity, it's, and this is their term, white evangelicalism.
Yeah.
If you look at how they cover the SBC, they use that term, white evangelicalism, constantly. And you'll see patriarchy a lot. And I think what you, to me, as I watch it, I look at, you know, the Ruth Grahams at the New York Times, Sarah Pulliam Bailey at the Washington Post, a lot of NPR coverage, a lot of Atlantic coverage, man. If you look in the Atlantic, it is just SBC all the time, it feels like, or SBC figures just constantly. David Brooks likes to get in there a lot too. And what I feel like is there is this external shaping that's going on based on, one, who within the SBC they cheer and jeer, and they do it a lot. And they use these stories to criticize this conservative theology, this conservative political outlook, because you have to say, look, this is a very politically conservative denomination as well. And one of the things you might wonder from the establishment media is this criticism a way to create a sense of insecurity that will make them want to go, how do we get on the good side of people and get more of these cheering articles? Because they do get them when they depart from, say, that complementarian theology, or the internal critics get a lot of fawning coverage. So I feel like that's part of what it is. It's a way to shape it. I started a piece that I have not finished yet that kind of made me laugh, where there were a multitude of articles came out at once in the New York Times, in the Atlantic, in the Washington Post, saying, here's the evangelicals who are trying to save this group from itself. And one of the ways they did that was say, you know, let's redefine pro-life. The good pro-life activists within the SBC are those who are holistic about all of life. So pro-life might mean wearing masks, getting COVID vaccinations. It might mean some sort of, you know, a beefed up social safety net. But let's not just make it mean being pro-life in the traditional sense of saving babies' lives. So that they're redefining terms with this. That was one of the things that was really fascinating to me, is that they're going, let's praise this. In this case, there was like a professor, Karen Swallow Pryor, and they're going, let's praise her for having the insight and intelligence to see that pro-life should mean something more than saving babies' lives. Where I go, gosh, once you do that, it really doesn't mean saving babies' lives anymore. And it's a way to blunt the effect of the pro-life movement. So that would be an example that gets away from this abuse stuff, that goes, this is how they're doing this. They are, in some ways, to me, externally trying to reshape the priorities of this group. And David French, boy.
I knew this was teeing you up.
I know, right? your boss and I have had a few conversations about this. But yeah, I mean, I look at him and I go, he has become sort of the voice of the so-called loyal opposition, in that he comes into these articles cheering everyone who is trying to sort of break down the denominational structures that they had. Is this external critic? And look, it gets so in the weeds to go the personal and political connections between this very small group of people, like David Brooks, Russell Moore, David French. You know, they write articles about each other all the time. They quote each other all the time. And it, to me, I go, if you're not really paying attention, it looks like this. Oh, he's just covering news. And I'm like, if you follow how closely connected they are, what it looks like is strategizing. Mm. It looks like a very closely connected interpersonal relationships where, look, let me just tell you, 30 minutes after that guidepost report dropped, 30 minutes after, Russell Moore put out an article in Christianity Today calling it an apocalypse and saying, as bad as he thought it would be, he was so much more horrified by what he actually read in the report. And I went, okay, either you just made that up, or somebody gave you an early copy of the report, which is a question I put to Guidepost. They didn't answer it. That's not in my coverage, just because not everything could go in the coverage. But so he knew that. And then immediately after that, both Pete Wenner and David French, who are close to Russell Moore and have written other articles about him in the Atlantic, put out these articles saying, look how terrible this is. And as proof, look how they treated, I'm not going to say, my friend, Russell Moore. Mm. So the whole thing is just, you know, like I said, on the surface, it looks like, oh, these are just people covering the news. Nah, these are people covering their friends.
Mm. That is really interesting. And maybe this is a good place to sort of start wrapping up, because I'm curious how you think all this affects the way the SBC will react if, as is expected, the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade in the coming days.
Well, you know, it was really interesting to me that in that Washington Post story involving Karen Swallow Pryor and the definition of pro-life, so many of these figures are very out and proud Never Trumpers. I mean, strong Never Trumpers. And that also goes to that David French Atlantic Association, because, of course, who is better known as being a Never Trumper than David French? And one of the things she said in it, and I'm paraphrasing, so I don't want to give the impression that this is a direct quote, but she said something to the effect of, you know, having worked in pro-life activism for decades, I don't even celebrate this because of how it, what kind of compromises, what political compromises were made to bring it about. And that was shocking to me, that I would go, look, if Joe Biden somehow, you know, were to flip and nominate people to the Supreme Court or to lower courts that would save babies' lives, I'm going to cheer that regardless. And so that was kind of one of the things that I go, so we're so split now that we cannot just celebrate the effect. We're still upset. We're so upset about the cause that you're not even sure you want the effect of saving innocent lives. So, you know, I if you're familiar with Vodi Bakum, he wrote this book called Fault Lines that basically said, I don't believe that there's going to be a coming together. And so that's kind of where I am. And that's maybe a little pessimistic, but I think they're headed for a split probably. And I don't think that there are some forces on the left in the establishment media who would be sad to see that, because of course it dilutes the influence of what this very large denomination does on a cultural level. So I think we're just at the point that whether it's, you know, what they believe about racism and how systemic it is in the US, what they believe about pro-life issues, what they believe about sexuality, because even that, you'll have a lot of people who say, oh, you know, I of course, submit to what the Bible says about sexuality, gender identity, but at the same time, they're introducing terms like something called pronoun hospitality, which would be go ahead and use the pronouns and, you know, affirm what we know to be a lie to show hospitality to transgender individuals. visiting our churches. So I think that that kind of a divide can't hold. And then in the long run, I think, you know, the obvious things are that this denomination could get destroyed by lawsuits. They have a tsunami of lawsuits coming their way now. And because it's such a loose association, churches can just go, oh, we're just not going to be involved in that anymore because we don't want to get messed, you know, entangled in all that. And we don't really want to see our money that we're putting in this collective pool to go to missions just go to settling lawsuits. So they, you know, could just pull out. And I think, you know, unless they back off before next year, this investigation, this third party investigation process is going to happen. And this ministry watch list is going to happen. And I think it could get very, very messy, given that, you know, the terms of how you get on that list are still very unclear.
Yeah, it's an important point. And if nobody else is going to, you know, do their due diligence and report out the reality of how this, you know, might work, Megan, I'm glad you are. My last question is, how reflective do you think this split that we see? You talked about this a little earlier, but the split that we see in SBC leadership is of a split that exists among churchgoers as well. My impression is that, you know, maybe it's like 70-30 or maybe more like 60-40. A lot of young evangelicals, if you look at their conferences and all of that, so there's some, oh, I don't know, some flirtation with this new cultural leftism that the secular world has mainstreamed. And of course, how could there not be? But I'm curious as to, you know, somebody who follows this, how reflective do you think it is of the split in, you know, the people that these leaders are supposed to be leading?
I mean, I think it's very reflective. And I have had some personal experience being in an institution where that split happened, and that, you know, I think probably there is, let's say, a 40% that is tends to be very traditionally politically, theologically conservative, 40%, you won't call them progressive by, you know, general terms, but certainly progressive within the realm of evangelicalism and Christianity. And then there's a 20% maybe in the middle that's like, and that 20% I think tends to be in the pastorate that goes, gosh, we need to try to keep peace between these two groups. And so they try to not sort of commit either way, and it leaves people in a lot of confusion. But I will say, even if you have a small group of really sort of committed activists that are coming from that more progressive wing, for whatever reason, they seem to feel a lot more confident in their convictions, and they feel a lot more confident making a lot of noise. And I would also say that that 20% of pastors in the middle are a little more afraid of them and afraid of getting criticism from them. And maybe part of the reason is because they have the ear of the New York Times and the Washington Post, and they don't want to see their name in that next article.
Mm. Megan Basham, fascinating story to follow and just great reporting. Thank you so much for breaking it down for us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Of course, we'll have
You're
to do
brave,
it again.
Emily. Nobody wants to touch this story.
I mean, come on. It's so important. As you sort of set the table in the beginning of your article, and you say this is the second biggest denomination in the country. It is the biggest Protestant denomination in the country. It's huge. It's the culture we're creeping into a massive group of Americans. And, you know, if nobody wants to touch it, like I said, I'm glad you did, Megan.
And I'm glad you are. Thank you for having me, Emily.
Of course, anytime. You can read that article over at the Daily Wire. It's called Southern Baptists Me Too Moment. Megan Basham is the culture reporter over there. Make sure to give her a follow and check out her work. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
I heard the faint voice of reason.